There was a rock that since the creation of the world had been worked upon by the pure essences of heaven and the fine savours of earth, the vigour of sunshine and the grace of moonlight, till at last it became magically pregnant, and one day split open, giving birth to a stone egg about as big as a playing ball. Fructified by the wind, it developed into a stone monkey, complete in every organ and limb. At once this monkey learned to climb and run, but its first act was to make a bow towards each of the four quarters. As it did so, a steely light darted from this monkey's eyes and flashed as far as the palace of the pole star. This shaft of light astonished the jade emperor as he sat in the cloud palace of the golden gates in the treasure hall of the holy mists, surrounded by his fairy ministers. Seeing this strange light flashing, he ordered Thousand-League Eye and Down-the-Wind Ears to open the gates of the southern heaven and look out. At his bidding, these two captains went out of the gate and looked so sharply and listened so well that presently they were able to report, "This steely light comes from the borders of the small country of Aeolai that lies to the east of the holy continent, from the mountain of flowers and fruit. On this mountain is a magic rock which gave birth to an egg. This egg changed into a stone monkey, and when he made his bow to the four quarters, a steely light flashed from his eyes with a beam that reached the palace of the pole star. But now he is taking a drink, and the light is growing dim." The jade emperor condescended to take an indulgent view. "These creatures in the world below," he said, "were compounded of the essence of heaven and earth, and nothing that goes on there should surprise us." That monkey walked, ran, leapt, and bounded over the hills, feeding on grasses and shrubs, drinking from streams and springs, gathering the mountain flowers, looking for fruits. Wolf, panther, and tiger were his companions, and the deer and civet were his friends, gibbons and baboons his kindred. At night he lodged under cliffs of rock, by day he wandered among the peaks and caves. One very hot morning, after playing in the shade of some pine trees, he and the other monkeys went to bathe in a mountain stream. "See how those waters bounce and tumble like rolling melons." There is an old saying, "Birds have their bird language, beasts have their beast talk." The monkeys said, "We none of us know where this stream comes from. As we have nothing to do this morning, wouldn't it be fun to follow it up to its source?" With a whoop of joy, dragging their sons and carrying their daughters, calling out to younger brother and elder brother, the whole troop rushed along the streamside and scrambled up the steep places till they reached the source of the stream. They found themselves standing before the curtain of a great waterfall. All the monkeys clapped their hands and cried aloud, "Lovely water! Lovely water! To think that it starts far off in some cavern below the base of the mountain and flows all the way to the great sea! If any of us were bold enough to pierce that curtain, get to where the water comes from and return unharmed, we would make him our king!" 3 times the call went out, when suddenly one of them leapt from among the throng and answered the challenge in a loud voice. It was the stone monkey. "I will go," he cried. "I will go. Look at him. He screws up his eyes and crouches. Then at one bound he jumps straight through the waterfall. When he opens his eyes and looks about him, he finds that where he'd landed, there was no water. A great bridge stretched in front of him, shining and glinting. When he looked closely at it, he saw it was made of burnished iron. The water under it flowed through a hole in the rock, filling in all the space under the arch. Monkey climbed up onto the bridge and, spying as he went, saw something that looked just like a house. There were stone seats and stone couches and tables with stone bowls and cups. He skipped back to the hump of the bridge and saw that on the cliff there was an inscription in large square writing which said, "This cave of the water curtain in the blessed land of the mountain of flowers and fruit leads to heaven." Monkey was beside himself with delight. He rushed back and again crouched, shut his eyes, and jumped through the curtain of water.
"A great stroke of luck," he cried. "A great stroke of luck." "What's it like on the other side?" asked the monkeys, crowding round him. "Is the water very deep?" "There is no water," said the stone monkey. "There is an iron bridge, and at the side of it, a heaven-sent place to live in."
"What made you think it would do to live in?" asked the monkeys.
"The water," said the stone monkey, "flows out of a hole in the rock, filling in the space under the bridge. At the side of the bridge are flowers and trees, and there is a chamber of stone. Inside are stone tables, stone cups, stone dishes, stone couches, stone seats. We could really be very comfortable there. There is plenty of room for hundreds and thousands of us, young and old. Let us all go and live there. We shall be splendidly sheltered in every weather." "You go first and show us how," cried the monkeys in great delight. Once more he closed his eyes and was through at one bound.
"Come along, all of you," he cried.
The bolder of them jumped at once. The more timid stretched out their heads and then drew back, scratched their ears, rubbed their cheeks, and then with a great shout the whole mob leapt forward. Soon they were all seizing dishes and snatching cups, scrambling to the hearth or fighting for the beds, dragging things along or shifting them about, behaving, indeed, as monkeys, with their mischievous nature, might be expected to do, never quiet for an instant, till at last they were all thoroughly worn out. The stone monkey took his seat at the head of them and said,
"Gentlemen, with one whose word cannot be trusted, there is nothing to be done. You promised that any of us who managed to get through the waterfall and back again should be your king. I have not only come and gone, and come again, but also found you a comfortable place to sleep, put you in the enviable position of being householders. Why do you not now bow down to me as your king?"
Thus reminded, the monkeys all pressed together the palms of their hands and prostrated themselves, drawn up in a line according to age and standing, and bowing humbly they cried, "Great king, 1,000 years! After this, the stone monkey discarded his old name and became king, with the title Handsome Monkey King. He appointed various monkeys, gibbons, and baboons to be his ministers and officers. By day, they wandered about the mountain of flowers and fruit. At night, they slept in the cave of the water curtain. They lived in perfect sympathy and accord, not mingling with bird or beast, in perfect independence and entire happiness. The Monkey King had enjoyed this artless existence for several hundred years, when one day, at a feast in which all the monkeys took part, the king suddenly felt very sad and burst into tears. His subjects at once ranged themselves in front of him and bowed down, saying, "Why is your majesty so sad?"
"At present," said the king, "I have no cause for unhappiness, but I have a misgiving about the future which troubles me sorely."
"Your majesty is very hard to please," said the monkeys, laughing. "Every day we have happy meetings on fairy mountains, in blessed spots, in ancient caves, on holy islands. We are not subject to the unicorn, nor phoenix, nor to the restraints of any human king. Such freedom is an immeasurable blessing. What can it be that causes you this sad misgiving?"
"It is true," said the Monkey King, "that today I am not answerable to the law of any human king, nor need I fear the menace of any beast or bird. But the time will come when I shall grow old and weak. Yama, king of death, is secretly waiting to destroy me. Is there no way by which, instead of being born again on earth, I might live forever among the people of the sky?"
When the monkeys heard this, they covered their faces with their hands and wept, each thinking of his own mortality.
But look, from among the ranks there springs out one monkey commoner who cries in a loud voice,
"If that is what troubles your majesty, it shows that religion has taken hold upon your heart. There are indeed among all creatures three kinds that are not subject to Yama, king of death."
"And do you know which they are?"
asked the Monkey King.
"Buddhas, immortals, and sages," he said.
These three are exempt from the turning of the wheel, from birth and destruction. They are eternal as heaven and earth, as the hills and streams.
Where are they to be found?
Asked the Monkey King. Here on the common earth, said the monkey, in ancient caves, among enchanted hills. The king was delighted with his news.
Tomorrow, he said, I shall say goodbye to you, go down the mountain, wander like a cloud to the corners of the sea, far away to the end of the world, till I have found these three kinds of immortal. From them I will learn how to be young forever and escape the doom of death.
This determination it was that led him to leap clear of the toils of reincarnation and turned him at last into the great monkey sage equal of heaven. The monkeys clapped their hands and cried aloud,
Splendid, splendid! Tomorrow we will scour the hills for fruits and berries and hold a great farewell banquet in honour of our king.
Next day they duly went to gather peaches and rare fruits, mountain herbs, yellow sperm, tubers, orchids, strange plants and flowers of every sort, and set out the stone tablets and benches, laid out fairy meats and drinks. They put the Monkey King at the head of the table and ranged themselves according to their age and rank. The pledge cup passed from hand to hand. They made their offerings to him of flowers and fruit. All day long they drank, and next day their king rose early and said,
Little ones, cut some pine wood for me and make me a raft, then find a tall bamboo for pole and put together a few fruits and such like. I am going to start.
He got onto the raft all alone and pushed off with all his might, speeding away and away straight out to sea till, favoured by a following wind, he arrived at the borders of the southern world. Fate indeed had favoured him. For days on end, ever since he set foot on the raft, a strong southeast wind blew and carried him at last to the northwestern bank, which is indeed the frontier of the southern world. He tested the water with his pole and found that it was shallow, so he left the raft and climbed ashore. On the beach were people fishing, shooting wild geese, scooping oysters, draining salt. He ran up to them, and for fun began to perform queer antics, which frightened them so much that they dropped their baskets and nets and ran for their lives. One of them, who stood his ground, Monkey caught hold of, and ripping off his clothes, found out how to wear them himself, and so, dressed up, went prancing through towns and cities in market and bazaar, imitating the people's manners and talk. All the while, his heart was set only on finding the immortals and learning from them the secret of eternal youth. But he found the men of the world all engrossed in the quest of profit or fame. There was not one who had any care for the end that was in store for him. So Monkey went looking for the way of immortality, but found no chance of meeting it. For 8 or 9 years he went from city to city and town to town, till suddenly he came to the Western Ocean. He was sure that beyond this ocean there would certainly be immortals, and he made for himself a raft like the one he had had before. He floated on over the Western Ocean till he came to the Western Continent, where he went ashore, and when he had looked about for some time, he suddenly saw a very high and beautiful mountain, thickly wooded at the base. He had no fear of wolves, tigers, or panthers, and made his way up to the very top. He was looking about him when he suddenly heard a man's voice coming from deep amid the woods. He hurried towards the spot and listened intently. It was someone singing, and these were the words that he caught. I hatch no plot, I scheme no scheme. Fame and shame are one to me. A simple life prolongs my days. Those I meet upon my way are immortals, one and all, who from their quiet seats expound the scriptures of the yellow court. When Monkey heard these words, he was very pleased. There must then be immortals somewhere hereabouts, he said. He sprang deep into the forest, and looking carefully, saw that the singer was a woodman who was cutting brushwood. Reverend immortal, said Monkey, coming forward.
"Your disciple raises his hands."
The woodman was so astonished that he dropped his axe.
"You have made a mistake,"
he said, turning and answering the salutation.
"I am only a shabby, hungry woodcutter. What makes you address me as an immortal?"
"If you are not an immortal," said Monkey, "why did you talk of yourself as though you were one?"
"What did I say?" asked the woodcutter. "That sounded as though I were an immortal."
"When I came to the edge of the wood," said Monkey, "I heard you singing. Those I meet upon my way are immortals, one and all, who from their quiet seats expound the scriptures of the Yellow Court. Those scriptures are secret Taoist texts. What can you be but an immortal?"
"I won't deceive you," said the woodcutter. "That song was indeed taught to me by an immortal who lives not far from my hut. He saw that I have to work hard for my living and have a lot of troubles. So he told me, when I was worried by anything, to say to myself the words of that song. This, he said, would comfort me and get me out of my difficulties. Just now I was upset about something, so I was singing that song. I had no idea that you were listening."
"If the immortal lives close by," said Monkey, "how is it that you have not become his disciple? Would it not have been as well to learn from him how never to grow old?"
"Oh, I have a hard time of it," said the woodcutter. "When I was 8 or 9, I lost my father. I had no brothers and sisters, and it fell upon me alone to support my widowed mother. There was nothing for it but to work hard early and late. Now my mother is old, and I dare not leave her. The garden is neglected. We have not enough either to eat or wear. The most I can do is cut 2 bundles of firewood, carry them to the market with a penny or two that I get by a few handfuls of rice, which I cook myself and serve to my Asian mother. I have no time to go and learn magic."
"From what you tell me," said Monkey, "I can see that you are a good and devoted son, and your piety will certainly be rewarded. All I ask of you is that you will show me where the immortal lives, for I should very much like to visit him."
"Why, it's quite close," said the woodcutter. "This mountain is called the Holy Terrace Mountain, and on it is a cave called the Cave of the Slanting Moon and 3 Stars. In that cave lives an immortal called the Patriarch Savodi. In his time, he has had innumerable disciples, and at this moment there are some 30 or 40 of them studying with him. You have only to follow that small path southwards for 8 or 9 leagues, and you will come to his home."
"Honoured brother,"
said Monkey, drawing the woodcutter towards him,
"come with me, and if I profit by the visit, I will not forget that you guided me."
"It takes a lot to make some people understand," said the woodcutter. "I've just been telling you why I can't go. If I went with you, what would become of my work? Who would give my old mother a food? I must go on cutting my wood, and you must find your way alone."
When Monkey heard this, he saw nothing for it but to say goodbye. He left the wood, found the path, went uphill for some 7 or 8 leagues, and sure enough found a cave dwelling. But the door was locked. All was quiet, and there was no sign of anyone being about. Suddenly he turned his head and saw on top of the cliff a stone slab about 30 feet high and 8 feet wide. On it was an inscription in large letters saying, "Cave of the Slanting Moon and 3 Stars on the Mountain of the Holy Terrace." "People here," said Monkey, "are certainly very truthful. There really is such a mountain and such a cave." He looked about for a while, but did not venture to knock at the door. Instead, he jumped up into a pine tree and began eating the pine seed and playing among the branches. After a time, he heard someone call. The door of the cave opened, and a fairy boy of great beauty came out, in appearance utterly unlike the common lads he had seen till now. The boy shouted,
"Who's making a disturbance out there?"
Monkey leapt down from his tree, and coming forward said with a bow,
Fairy boy, I am a pupil who has come to study immortality. I should not dream of making a disturbance.
You, a pupil?
Said the boy, laughing.
To be sure,
said Monkey. My master is lecturing, said the boy. But before he gave out his theme, he told me to go to the door, and if anyone came asking for instruction, I was to look after him. I suppose he meant you.
Of course he meant me,
said Monkey. Follow me this way, said the boy. Monkey tidied himself and followed the boy into the cave. Huge chambers opened out before them. They went on from room to room, through lofty halls and innumerable cloisters and retreats, till they came to a platform of green jade, upon which was seated the patriarch Sabaudi, with 30 lesser immortals assembled before him. Monkey at once prostrated himself, and bumped his head 3 times upon the ground, murmuring,
Master, master, as pupil to teacher, I pay you my humble respects.
Where do you come from?
Asked the patriarch.
First tell me your country and name, and then pay your respects again.
I am from the Water Curtain Cave, said Monkey, on the Mountain of Fruit and Flowers, in the country of Aeolai.
Go away,
shouted the patriarch.
I know the people there. They're a tricky, humbugging set. It's no good one of them supposing he's going to achieve enlightenment.
Monkey, kowtowing violently, hastened to say,
There is no trickery about this. It's just the plain truth I am telling you.
If you claim that you're telling the truth,
said the patriarch,
how is it that you say you came from Aeolai? Between there and here, there are 2 oceans and the whole of the southern continent. How did you get here?
I floated over the oceans and wandered over the lands for 10 years and more,
said Monkey,
till at last I reached here.
Oh, well,
said the patriarch.
I suppose if you came by easy stages, it's not altogether impossible. But tell me, what is your hissing?
I never show hissing, said Monkey. If I am abused, I am not at all annoyed. If I am hit, I am not angry. But on the contrary, twice more polite than before. All my life I have never shown hissing.
I don't mean that kind of hissing, said the patriarch. I mean, what was your family? What surname had they?
I had no family, said Monkey, neither father nor mother.
Oh, indeed, said the patriarch. Perhaps you grew on a tree.
Not exactly, said Monkey. I came out of a stone. There was a magic stone on the Mountain of Flowers and Fruit. When its time came, it burst open, and I came out.
We shall have to see about giving you a school name, said the patriarch. We have 12 words that we use in these names, according to the grade of the pupil. You are in the 10th grade.
What are the 12 words?
Asked Monkey.
They are wide, big, wise, clever, true, conforming, nature, ocean, lively, aware, perfect, and illumined. As you belong to the 10th grade, the word aware must come into your name. How about aware of vacuity?
Splendid,
said Monkey, laughing.
From now onwards, let me be called aware of vacuity.
So that was his name in religion. And if you do not know whether in the end, equipped with this name, he managed to obtain enlightenment or not, listen while it is explained to you in the next chapter. Monkey was so pleased with his new name that he skipped up and down in front of the patriarch, bowing to express his gratitude. Sabaudi then ordered his pupils to take Monkey to the outer rooms and teach him how to sprinkle and dust, answer properly when spoken to, how to come in, go out, and go round. Then he bowed to his fellow pupils and went out into the corridor, where he made himself a sleeping place. Early next morning, he and the others practiced the correct mode of speech and bearing, studied the scriptures, discussed doctrine, practiced writing, burnt incense.
And in this same way he passed day after day, spending his leisure in sweeping the floor, hoeing the garden, growing flowers and tending trees, getting firewood and lighting the fire, drawing water and carrying it in buckets. Everything he needed was provided for him, and so he lived in the cave while time slipped by for 6 or 7 years. One day the patriarch, seated in state, summoned all his pupils and began a lecture on the Great Way. Monkey was so delighted by what he heard that he tweaked his ears and rubbed his cheeks, his brow flowered, and his eyes laughed. He could not stop his hands from dancing, his feet from stamping. Suddenly the patriarch caught sight of him and shouted,
"What is the use of your being here if, instead of listening to my lecture, you jump up and dance like a maniac?"
"I am listening with all my might," said Monkey. "But you were saying such wonderful things that I could not contain myself for joy. That is why I may, for all I know, have been hopping and jumping. Don't be angry with me."
"So you recognize the profundity of what I am saying," said the patriarch. "How long, pray, have you been in the cave?"
"It may seem rather silly," said Monkey, "but really I don't know how long. All I can remember is that when I was sent to get firewood, I went up the mountain behind the cave, and then I found a whole slope covered with peach trees. I have eaten my fill of those peaches 7 times.
"It is called the Hill of Bright Peach Blossom," said the patriarch. "If you have eaten there 7 times, I suppose you have been here 7 years. What sort of wisdom are you now hoping to learn from me?"
"I leave that to you," said Monkey. "Any sort of wisdom is all one to me."
"There are 360 schools of wisdom," said the patriarch, "and all of them lead to self-attainment. Which school do you want to study?"
"Just as you think best," said Monkey. "I'm all attention."
"Well, how about art?" asked the patriarch. "Would you like me to teach you that?"
"What sort of wisdom is that?"
asked Monkey. "You would be able to summon fairies and ride the phoenix," said the patriarch. "Divine by shuffling the yarrow stalks, and know how to avoid disaster and pursue good fortune."
"But should I live forever?"
asked Monkey. "Certainly not," said the patriarch.
"Then that's no good to me," said Monkey.
"How about natural philosophy?" asked the patriarch.
"What is that about?"
asked Monkey. "It means the teaching of Confucius," said the patriarch, "and of Buddha, and Lao Tzu, of the dualists, and Mo Tzu, and the doctors of medicine, reading scriptures, saying prayers, learning how to have adepts and sages at your beck and call."
"But should I live forever?" asked Monkey.
"If that's what you are thinking about," said the patriarch, "I am afraid philosophy is no better than a prop in the wall."
"Master," said Monkey, "I am a plain, simple man, and I don't understand that sort of patter. What do you mean by a prop in the wall?"
"When men are building a room," said the patriarch, "and want it to stand firm, they put a pillar to prop up the walls. But one day the roof falls in and the pillar rots."
"That doesn't sound much like long life," said Monkey. "I'm not going to learn philosophy."
"How about quietism?" asked the patriarch.
"What does that consist of?"
asked Monkey. "Low diet," said the patriarch, "inactivity, meditation, restraint of word and deed, yoga, practiced prostrate or standing."
"But should I live forever?" asked Monkey.
"The results of quietism," said the patriarch, "are no better than unbaked clay in the kiln."
"You've got a very poor memory," said Monkey. "Didn't I tell you just now that I don't understand that sort of patter? What do you mean by unbaked clay in the kiln?"
"The bricks and tiles," said the patriarch, "may be waiting, all shaped and ready in the kiln. But if they have not yet been fired, there will come a day when heavy rain falls and they are washed away.
That does not promise well for the future, said Monkey. I don't think I'll bother about quietism.
You might try exercises, said the patriarch.
What do you mean by that?
Asked Monkey. Various forms of activity, said the patriarch, such as the exercises called gathering the yin and patching the yang, drawing the bow and treading the catapult, rubbing the navel to pass breath. Then there are the alchemical practices, such as the magical explosion, burning the reeds, and striking the tripod, promoting red lead, melting the autumn stone, and drinking bride's milk.
Would these make me live forever?
Asked Monkey. To hope for that, said the patriarch, would be like trying to fish the moon out of the water.
There you go again, said Monkey. What, pray, do you mean by fishing the moon out of the water?
When the moon is in the sky, said the patriarch, it is reflected in the water. It looks just like the real thing. But if you try to catch hold of it, you'll find it is only an illusion.
That does not sound much good, said Monkey. I shan't learn exercises.
Tut!
Cried the patriarch, and coming down from the platform, he caught hold of the knuckle wrapper and pointed it at Monkey, saying,
You wretched simian! You won't learn this and you won't learn that! I should like to know what it is you do want!
And so saying, he struck Monkey over the head 3 times. Then he folded his hands behind his back and strode off into the inner room, dismissing his audience and locking the door behind him. The pupils all turned indignantly upon Monkey. You villainous ape! They shouted at him. Do you think this is the way to behave? The master offers to teach you, and instead of accepting thankfully, you begin arguing with him. Now he's thoroughly offended, and goodness knows when he'll come back. They were all very angry and poured abuse on him, but Monkey was not in the least upset, and merely replied by a broad grin. The truth of the matter was, he understood the language of secret signs. That was why he did not take up the quarrel or attempt to argue. He knew that the master, by striking him 3 times, was giving him an appointment at the 3rd watch, and by going off with his hands folded behind his back, meant that Monkey was to look for him in the inner apartments. The locking of the door meant that he was to come round by the back door and would then receive instruction. The rest of the day he frolicked with the other pupils in front of the cave, impatiently awaiting the night. As soon as dusk came, like the others, he went to his sleeping place. He closed his eyes and pretended to be asleep, breathing softly and regularly. In the mountains there is no watchman to beat the watches or call the hours. The best Monkey could do was to count his incoming and outgoing breaths. When he reckoned that it must be about the hour of the rat, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m., he got up very quietly and slipped on his clothes, softly opened the front door, left his companions, and went round to the back door. Sure enough, it was only half shut. The master certainly means to give me instruction, said Monkey to himself. That is why he left the door open. So he crept in and went straight to the master's bed. Finding him curled up and lying with his face to the wall, Monkey dared not wake him and knelt down beside the bed. Presently the patriarch woke, stretched out his legs, and murmured to himself,
Hard, very hard. The way is most secret. Never handle the golden elixir as though it were a mere toy. He who to unworthy ears entrusts the dark truths, to no purpose works his jaws and talks his tongue dry.
Master, I have been kneeling here for some time, said Monkey,
when he saw that the patriarch was awake.
"You wretched monkey,"
said Sibodi, who, on recognizing his voice, pulled off the bedclothes and sat up.
"Why aren't you asleep in your own quarters, instead of coming round behind to mine?"
"At the lecture today," said Monkey, "you ordered me to come for instruction at the third watch, by way of the back gate. That is why I ventured to come straight to your bed." The patriarch was delighted. He thought to himself, "This fellow must really be, as he says, a natural product of heaven and earth. Otherwise, he would never have understood my secret signs." "We are alone together," said Monkey. "There is no one to overhear us. Take pity upon me and teach me the way of long life. I shall never forget your kindness."
"You show a disposition," said the patriarch. "You understood my secret signs. Come close and listen carefully. I am going to reveal to you the secret of long life."
Monkey beat his head onto the floor to show his gratitude, washed his ears and attended closely, kneeling beside the bed. The patriarch then recited,
"To spare and tend the vital powers, this and nothing else, is sum and total of all magic, secret and profane. All is comprised in these three, spirit, breath, and soul. Guard them closely, screen them well, let there be no leak, store them within the frame. That is all that can be learned and all that can be taught. I would have you mark the tortoise and snake locked in tight embrace, locked in tight embrace. The vital powers are strong. Even in the midst of fierce flames, the golden lotus may be planted. The five elements compounded and transposed are put to new use. When that is done, be which you please, Buddha or immortal."
By these words, Monkey's whole nature was shaken to the foundations. He carefully committed them to memory, then humbly thanked the patriarch, and went out again by the back door. A pale light was just coming into the eastern sky. He retraced his steps, softly opened the front door, and returned to his sleeping place, purposely making a rustling noise with his bedclothes.
"Get up!" he cried. "There is light in the sky."
His fellow pupils were fast asleep and had no idea that Monkey had received illumination. Time passed swiftly, and 3 years later the patriarch again mounted his jeweled seat and preached to his assembled followers. His subject was the parables and scholastic problems of the Zen sect, and his theme the tegument of outer appearances. Suddenly he broke off and asked,
"Where is the disciple aware of vacuity?"
Monkey knelt down before him and answered,
"Here."
"What have you been studying all this time?" asked the patriarch.
"Recently," said Monkey, "my spiritual nature has been very much in the ascendant, and my fundamental sources of power are gradually strengthening."
"In that case," said the patriarch, "all you need learn is how to ward off the three calamities."
"There must be some mistake," said Monkey in dismay. "I understood that the secrets I have learned would make me live forever and protect me from fire, water, and every kind of disease. What is this about three calamities?"
"What you have learned," said the patriarch, "will preserve your youthful appearance and increase the length of your life. But after 500 years, heaven will send down lightning, which will finish you off, unless you have the sagacity to avoid it. After another 500 years, heaven will send down a fire that will devour you. This fire is of a peculiar kind. It is neither common fire nor celestial fire, but springs up from within and consumes the vitals, reducing the whole frame to ashes and making a vanity of all your 1,000 years of self-perfection. But even should you escape this, In another 500 years, a wind will come and blow upon you. Not the east wind, the south wind, the west wind, or the north wind. Not flower wind, or willow wind, pine wind, or bamboo wind. It blows from below, enters the bowels, passes the midriff, and issues at the 9 apertures. It melts bone and flesh, so that the whole body dissolves. These 3 calamities you must be able to avoid.
When Monkey heard this, his hair stood on end, and prostrating himself, he said, I beseech you, have pity upon me, and teach me how to avoid these calamities. I shall never forget your kindness.
There would be no difficulty about that, said the patriarch, if it were not for your peculiarities.
I have a round head sticking up to heaven and square feet treading earth, said Monkey. I have 9 apertures, 4 limbs, 5 upper and 6 lower internal organs, just like other people.
You are like other men in most respects, said the patriarch, but you have much less jowl.
For monkeys have hollow cheeks and pointed nozzles.
Monkey felt his face with his hand and laughed, saying,
Master, I have my debits, but don't forget my assets. I have my pouch, and that must be credited to my account as something that ordinary humans haven't got.
True enough, said the patriarch. There are 2 methods of escape. Which would you like to learn? There is the trick of the heavenly ladle, which involves 36 kinds of transformation, and the trick of the earthly conclusion, which involves 72 kinds of transformation.
72 sounds better value, said Monkey.
Come here, then,
said the patriarch,
and I will teach you the formula.
He then whispered a magic formula into Monkey's ear. That Monkey King was uncommonly quick at taking things in. He at once began practicing the formula, and after a little self-discipline, he mastered all the 72 transformations, whole and complete. One day, when master and disciples were in front of the cave, admiring the evening view, the patriarch said,
Monkey, how is that business going?
Thanks to your kindness, said Monkey, I have been extremely successful. In addition to the transformations, I can already fly.
Let's see you do it, said the patriarch.
Monkey put his feet together, leapt about 60 feet into the air, and riding the clouds for a few minutes, dropped in front of the patriarch. He did not get more than 3 leagues in the whole of his flight.
Master, he said, that surely is cloud-soaring.
I should be more inclined to call it cloud-crawling, said the patriarch, laughing. The old saying runs, an immortal wanders in the morning to the northern sea, and the same evening he is in Tsang-wu. To take as long as you did, to go a mere league or two, hardly counts even as cloud-crawling.
What is meant by that saying about the northern sea and Tsang Wu?
Asked Monkey.
A real cloud soarer, said the patriarch, can start early in the morning from the northern sea, cross the eastern sea and the western sea and the southern sea, and land again at Tsang Wu. Tsang Wu means Ling Ling in the northern sea. To do the round of all 4 seas in one day is true cloud-soaring.
That sounds very difficult, said Monkey.
Nothing in the world is difficult, said the patriarch. It is only our own thoughts that make things seem so.
Master, said Monkey, prostrating himself, you may as well make a good job of me. While you're about it, do me a real kindness and teach me the art of cloud-soaring. I shall never forget how much I owe to you.
When the immortals go cloud-soaring, said the patriarch, they sit cross-legged and rise straight from that position. You do nothing of the kind. I saw you just now put your feet together and jump. I really must take this opportunity of teaching you how to do it properly. You shall learn the cloud trapeze.
He then taught him the magic formula, saying,
Make the pass, recite the spell, clench your fists, and one leap will carry you head over heels 108,000 leagues.
When the other pupils heard this, they all tittered, saying, Monkey is in luck. If he learns this trick, he will be able to carry dispatches, deliver letters, take round circulars, one way or another. He will always be able to pick up a living. It was now late. Master and pupils all went to their quarters, but Monkey spent all night practicing the cloud trapeze, and by the time day came, he had completely mastered it and could wander through space where he would. One summer day, when the disciples had for some time been studying their tasks under a pine tree, one of them said, Monkey, what can you have done in a former incarnation to merit that the master should, the other day, have whispered in your ear the secret formula for avoiding the 3 calamities? Have you mastered all those transformations? To tell you the truth, said Monkey, although, of course, I am much indebted to the master for his instruction, I have also been working very hard day and night on my own, and now I can do them all. Wouldn't this be a good opportunity, said one of the pupils, to give us a little demonstration? When Monkey heard this, he was all on his mettle to display his powers. Give me my subject, he said. What am I to change into? How about a pine tree, they said. He made a magic pass, recited a spell, shook himself, and changed into a pine tree. The disciples clapped and burst into loud applause. Bravo, Monkey, bravo, they cried. There was such a din that the patriarch came running out with his staff trailing after him.
Who's making all this noise?
He asked. The disciples at once controlled themselves, smoothed down their dresses, and came meekly forward. Monkey changed himself back into his true form and slipped in among the crowd, saying,
Reverend Master, we were doing our lessons out here. I assure you there was no noise in particular.
You were all bawling, said the patriarch angrily. It didn't sound in the least like people studying. I want to know what you were doing here, shouting and laughing.
To tell the truth, said someone, Monkey was showing us a transformation just for fun. We told him to change into a pine tree, and he did it so well that we were all applauding him. That was the noise you heard. I hope you will forgive us.
Go away, all of you!
The patriarch shouted.
And you, Monkey, come here. What were you doing? Playing with your spiritual powers, turning into, what was it, a pine tree? Do you think I taught you in order that you might show off in front of other people? If you saw someone else turn into a tree, wouldn't you at once ask how it was done? If others see you doing it, aren't they certain to ask you? If you are frightened to refuse, you will give the secret away, and if you refuse, you're very likely to be roughly handled. You're putting yourself in grave danger.
I'm terribly sorry, said Monkey.
I won't punish you, said the patriarch, but you can't stay here.
Monkey burst into tears.
Where am I to go?
He asked.
Back to where you came from, I should suppose, said the patriarch.
You don't mean back to the cave of the water curtain in Aeolai,
said Monkey.
Yes, said the patriarch. Go back as quickly as you can, if you value your life. One thing is certain in any case. You can't stay here.
May I point out, said Monkey, that I have been away from home for 20 years. I should be very glad to see my monkey subjects once more, but I can't consent to go till I have repaid you for all your kindness.
I have no desire to be repaid, said the patriarch. All I ask is that if you get into trouble, you should keep my name out of it.
Monkey saw that it was no use arguing. He bowed to the patriarch and took leave of his companions.
Wherever you go, said the patriarch, I'm convinced you'll come to no good. So remember, when you get into trouble, I absolutely forbid you to say that you are my disciple. If you give a hint of any such thing, I shall flay you alive, break all your bones, and banish your soul to the place of ninefold darkness, where it will remain for 10,000 eons.
I certainly won't venture to say a word about you, promised Monkey. I'll say I found it all out for myself.
So saying, he bade farewell, turned away, and making the magic pass, rode off on his cloud trapeze straight to the eastern sea. In a very little while, he reached the mountain of flowers and fruit, where he lowered his cloud and was picking his way when he heard a sound of cranes calling and monkeys crying.
"Little ones,"
he shouted,
"I have come back."
At once, from every cranny in the cliff, from bushes and trees, great monkeys and small, leapt out with cries of "Long live our king!" Then they all pressed round Monkey, kowtowing and saying, "Great king, you're very absent-minded. Why did you go away for so long, leaving us all in the lurch, panting for your return as a starving man for food and drink? For some time past, a demon has been ill-using us. He has seized our cave, though we fought desperately, and now he has robbed us of all our possessions and carried off many of our children, so that we have to be on the watch all the time and get no sleep day or night. It's lucky you have come now, for if you had waited another year or two, you'd have found us and everything hereabouts in another's hands."
"What demon can dare commit such crimes?" cried Monkey. "Tell me all about it, and I will avenge you." "Your Majesty," they said, "he is called the Demon of Havoc, and he lives due north from here."
"How far off?"
asked Monkey.
"He comes like a cloud," they said, "and goes like a mist, like wind or rain, thunder or lightning. We don't know how far away he lives."
"Oh, don't worry,"
said Monkey.
"Just go on playing around while I go and look for him."
Dear Monkey King, he sprang into the sky, straight northwards, and soon saw in front of him a high and very rugged mountain. He was admiring the scenery when he suddenly heard voices. Going a little way down the hill, he found a cave, in front of which several small imps were jumping and dancing. When they saw Monkey, they ran away.
"Stop!"
he called. "I've got a message for you to take. Say that the master of the Water Curtain Cave is here. The Demon of Havoc, or whatever he's called, who lives here, has been ill-treating my little ones, and I have come on purpose to settle matters with him." They rushed into the cave and cried out,
"Great King, a terrible thing has happened."
"What's the matter?"
asked the demon.
"Outside the cave," they said, "there's a monkey-headed creature who says he's the owner of the Water Curtain Cave. He says you have been ill-using his people, and he has come on purpose to settle matters with you."
"Ha-ha!"
laughed the demon.
"I have often heard these monkeys say that their king had gone away to learn religion. This means that he's come back again. What does he look like, and how is he armed?"
"He carries no weapon at all," they said.
"He goes bareheaded, wears a red dress with a yellow sash and black shoes. Neither priest nor layman, nor quite like a Taoist, he's waiting naked-handed outside the gate."
"Bring me my whole accoutrement," cried the demon.
The small imps at once fetched his arms. The demon put on his helmet and breastplate, grasped his sword, and going to the gate with the little imps, cried in a loud voice,
"Where's the owner of the Water Curtain Cave?"
"What's the use of having such large eyes?"
shouted Monkey.
"If you can't see old Monkey."
Catching sight of him, the demon burst out laughing.
"You're not a foot high, or as much as 30 years old. You have no weapon in your hand. How dare you strut about talking of settling accounts with me?"
"Cursed demon,"
said Monkey.
"After all, you have no eyes in your head. You say I am small, not seeing that I can make myself as tall as I please. You say I am unarmed, not seeing that these two hands of mine could drag the moon from the ends of heaven. Stand your ground and eat old Monkey's fist."
So saying, he leapt into the air and aimed a blow at the demon's face. The demon parried the blow with his hand.
"Just you, such a pygmy, and I so tall," said the demon. "You using your fists and I my sword? No, if I were to slay you with my sword, I should make myself ridiculous. I'm going to throw away my sword and use my naked fists."
"Very good," said Monkey.
"Now, my fine fellow, come on."
The demon relaxed his guard and struck. Monkey closed with him, and the two of them pommeled and kicked blow for blow. A long reach is not so firm and sure as a short one. Monkey jabbed the demon in the lower ribs, pounded him in the chest, and gave him such a heavy drubbing that at last the demon stood back and, picking up his great flat sword, slashed at Monkey's head. But Monkey swiftly stepped aside, and the blow missed its mark. Seeing that the demon was becoming savage, Monkey now used the method called body outside the body. He plucked out a handful of hairs, bit them into small pieces, and then spat them out into the air, crying, "Change!" The fragments of hair changed into several hundred small monkeys, all pressing round in a throng. For you must know that when anyone becomes an immortal, he can project his soul, change his shape, and perform all kinds of miracles. Monkey, since his illumination, could change every one of the 84,000 hairs of his body into whatever he chose. The little monkeys he had now created were so nimble that no sword could touch them nor spear wound them. See how they leap forward and jump back, crowd round the demon, some hugging, some pulling, some jabbing at his chest, some swarming up his legs. They kicked, beat him, pummeled his eyes, pinched his nose, and while they were all at it, Monkey slipped up and snatched away the demon's sword. Then, pushing through the throng of small monkeys, he raised the sword and brought it down with such tremendous force upon the demon's skull that he clove it in twain. He and the little monkeys then rushed into the cave and made a quick end of the imps, great and small. He then said a spell which caused the small monkeys to change back into hares. These he put back where they had come from. But there were still some small monkeys left, those that the demon had carried off from the cave of the water curtain. "How did you get there?" he asked. There were about 30 or 40 of them, and they all said with tears in their eyes, "After your majesty went away to become an immortal, we were pestered by this creature for 2 years. In the end he carried us all off, and he stole all the fittings from our cave. He took all the stone dishes and the stone cups."
"Collect everything that belongs to us and bring it with you," said Monkey.
They then set fire to the cave and burned everything in it.
"Now follow me," said Monkey.
"When we were brought here," they said, "we only felt a great wind rushing past, which whirled us to this place. We didn't know which way we were coming, so how are we to find the way home?"
"He brought you here by magic," said Monkey.
"But what matter? I am now up to all that sort of thing, and if he could do it, I can. Shut your eyes, all of you, and don't be frightened." He then recited a spell which produced a fierce wind. Suddenly it dropped, and Monkey shouted, "You may look now." The monkeys found that they were standing on firm ground quite close to their home. In high delight, they all followed a familiar path back to the door of their cave. They and those who had been left behind all pressed into the cave and lined up according to their rank and age, and did homage to their king, and prepared a great banquet of welcome. When they asked how the demon had been subdued and the monkeys rescued, he told them the whole story, upon which they burst into shouts of applause.
"We little thought," they said, "that when your majesty left us, you would learn such arts as this."
"After I parted from you," said Monkey, "I went across many oceans to the land of Jumbadvipa, where I learned human ways, how to wear clothes and shoes. I wandered restless as a cloud for 8 or 9 years, but nowhere could I find enlightenment. At last, after crossing yet another ocean, I was lucky enough to meet an old patriarch who taught me the secret of eternal life."
"What an incredible piece of luck," the monkey said, all congratulating him.
"Little ones," said Monkey, "I have another bit of good news for you. Your king has got a name in religion. I am called Aware of Vacuity." They all clapped loudly and presently went to get date wine and grape wine and fairy flowers and fruit, which they offered to Monkey. Everyone was in the highest spirits.
If you do not know what the upshot was, and how he fared, now that he was back in his old home, you must listen to what is related in the next chapter. Monkey, having returned in triumph after slaying the demon of havoc and snatching the demon's huge cutlass, practiced sword play every day and taught the small monkeys how to sharpen bamboos with spears, make wooden swords and banners to carry, and how to go on patrol, advance and retreat, pitch camp, build stockades, and so on. They had great fun doing this, but suddenly, sitting in a quiet place, Monkey thought to himself, "All this is only a game, but the consequences of it may be serious. Suppose some human king, or king of birds, or beasts, should hear what we are at. He may very well think that we are hatching a conspiracy against him and bring his armies to attack us. Bamboo, spears, and wooden swords wouldn't help you much then. You ought to have real swords and lances and halberds. How are we to get hold of them?"
"That's an excellent idea," they said, "but there's nowhere we could possibly get them from."
At this point, four old monkeys came forward, two red-bottomed horse apes and two tailless apes with plain behinds.
"Great king," they said, "if you want to get weapons made, nothing could be easier."
"Why do you think it's so easy?" asked Monkey.
"East of our mountains,"
they said,
"there are 200 leagues of water. That is the frontier of Aeolai. And at that frontier there's a king whose city is full of soldiers. He must certainly have metal works of all sorts. If you go there, you can certainly buy weapons or get them made for you. Then you can teach us to use them, and we shall be able to defend ourselves. That's the way to protect us against extinction."
Monkey was delighted with this idea. "You stay here and amuse yourselves," he said, "while I go off and see what can be done." Dear Monkey, he set out on his cloud trapeze, and in a twinkling he had crossed these 200 leagues of water, and on the other side there was indeed a city with walls and moat, with wards and markets, and myriad streets where men walked up and down in the happy sunshine. He thought to himself, "In such a place there are sure to be ready-made weapons. I'll go down and buy some, or better still, I'll get some by magic." He made a magic pass, recited a spell, and drew a magic diagram on the ground. He then stood in the middle of it, drew a long breath, and expelled it with such force that sand and stones hurtled through the air. This tempest so much alarmed the king of the country and all his subjects that they locked themselves indoors. Monkey lowered his cloud, made straight for the government buildings, and soon, finding the arsenal, he forced open the door and saw a vast supply of swords, lances, scimitars, halberds, axes, scythes, whips, rakes, cudgels, bows and crossbows, every conceivable weapon. "That's rather more than I can carry," he said to himself. So, as before, he changed his hares into thousands of small monkeys who began snatching at the weapons. Some managed to carry 6 or 7, others 3 or 4, till soon the arsenal was bare. Then a great gale of magic wind carried them back to the cave. The monkeys at home were playing in front of the cave door when suddenly they saw a great swarm of monkeys in the sky above, which scared them so much they all rushed into hiding. Soon Monkey lowered his cloud and turned the thousands of little monkeys into hares. He stacked the weapons on the hillside and cried, "Little ones, all come and get your arms." To their astonishment, they found Monkey standing all alone on the ground. They rushed forward to pay homage, and Monkey explained to them what had happened. When they had congratulated him on his performance, they all began to grab at swords and cutlasses, pick up axes, scramble for spears, drag off bows and crossbows. This sport, which was a very noisy one, lasted all day. Next day they came on parade as usual, and the roll call disclosed that they numbered 47,000 in all. All the wild beasts of the mountain and demon kings of every kind, denizens of no less than 72 caves, came to pay homage to Monkey, and henceforward brought tribute every year and signed on once in every season. Some supplied labor and some provisions. The mountain of flowers and fruit became as strong as an iron bucket or wall of bronze. The demon kings of various districts also presented bronze drums, colored banners, helmets, and coats of mail. Day after day, there was a tremendous bustle of drilling and marching. Everything was going well, when suddenly one day Monkey said to his subjects, "You seem to be getting on very well with your drill, but I find my sword very cumbersome. In fact, not at all to my liking. What is to be done?" The four old monkeys came forward and said,
"Great King, it is quite natural that you, being an immortal, should not care to use this earthly weapon. Do you think it would be possible for you to get one from the denizens of the sea?"
"Why not, pray?" said Monkey. "Since my illumination, I have mastery of 72 transformations. Greatest wonder of all, I can ride upon the clouds. I can become invisible. I can penetrate bronze and stone. Water cannot drown me any more than fire can burn me. What's to prevent me getting a weapon from the powers of the sea?"
"Well, if you can manage it," they said, "the water that flows under this iron bridge comes up from the palace of the dragon of the eastern sea. How about going down and paying a call upon the dragon king? If you asked him for a weapon, he would no doubt be able to find you something suitable."
"I'll certainly go," said Monkey. He went to the bridgehead, recited a spell to protect himself from the effects of water, and jumped in, making his way along the watercourse till he came to the bottom of the eastern sea. Presently he was stopped by a yaksha, who was patrolling the waters.
"What deity is that?"
he asked.
"Pushing along through the water, give an account of yourself, and I will announce your arrival."
"I am the Monkey King of the Mountain of Flowers and Fruit," said Monkey. "I am a near neighbour of the Dragon King, and consider that I ought to make his acquaintance."